pull up a chair. I want to take you back to a summer evening in England. Hatfield Aerodrome, just north of London, the 27th of July 1949, 77 years ago to the day. There's an airplane sitting on the grass that doesn't look like anything anybody has seen before. No propellers, not one, just a smooth silver fuselage, wings swept back a touch, and four engines buried right down inside the wing roots where they meet the body. Clean, quiet, until it isn't. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hangar. And today, on this day in aviation, we're going to talk about the airplane that dragged the whole world out of the propeller age and into the jet age, and about the terrible hard-won lesson she taught us on the way, the de Havilland DH-106 Comet. Now before we fire up those engines, let me tell you who's keeping the coffee hot this morning. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. Your first solo, your private ticket, your instrument rating, on up. If you earned it, they've got a coin that tells the story. Every one of them means something. Go have a look at AviationSoul.com. All right, let me set the scene. After the Second World War, flying the ocean meant piston airliners. Big, beautiful, complicated machines. Constellations, DC-6s and 7s. Rows of cylinders, gallons of oil, and a sound that would rattle the fillings loose in your teeth. You flew low, down where the weather lived. It was loud, it was rough, and a hop across the Atlantic could take you the better part of a day with a fuel stop tucked in the middle. The British had a notion. A committee sat down during the war, while the bombs were still falling, and asked a bold question. What comes after the piston engine? And a company named de Havilland, the same outfit that built that gorgeous wooden mosquito, said, "We'll build you a jet that carries passengers." Everybody thought they were mad. Here's the thing about a jet turbine. It wants to be up high, up in the thin, cold air, where there's less drag, where the engine breathes efficient and the ride is smooth as glass, above the weather instead of down in it. But nobody had ever built a pressurized tube to carry ordinary people up to 40,000 feet and do it day after day, flight after flight. De Havilland built her anyway, four ghost engines. That was the name. The de Havilland ghost turbojet sunk right into the wing roots so the wing stayed clean. She seated around 36 passengers in a cabin that was for its day absolute luxury. Big seats, tables, and windows. Lovely, generous square picture windows so the well-heeled traveler could look down on the clouds from a height no airliner passenger had ever seen. Remember those windows? We'll come back to them. On that July evening in 1949, De Havilland's chief test pilot, a man named John Cunningham, climbed aboard. Now Cunningham was a legend already. During the war, they called him Cat's Eyes Cunningham, a night fighter ace. Though the truth is the nickname was cover for the secret radar he was really using. Cool hand, nerveless, the right man for the job. He ran those four turbines up, and instead of the bark and roar of pistons, there was this smooth rising whistle, a sound the aerodrome had never heard. He rolled her down the grass and lifted off into the evening light, and the jet age for passengers right there was born. Now here's where it gets interesting. She went into service with BOAC, British Overseas Airways Corporation, in 1952, and she was a sensation. Passengers couldn't believe it. Smooth, quiet, fast. She'd cruise up around 480 miles an hour when the piston airliners were dragging along 200 slower. She flew above the bumps. You could set a coin on your table and it would sit there. Folks would step off the airplane and just marvel that their coffee hadn't spilled the whole way.
London to Johannesburg. London to Tokyo's. The Comet cut travel times in half and made the rest of the world's airlines look like they were standing still. Britain, a nation still on rationing, still digging out from the war, had leapt out in front of everybody. The Americans, Boeing and Douglas, were caught flat-footed. They were still bolting propellers onto things. For about 2 years, the Comet was the future. And then the future started falling out of the sky. Let me slow down here because this is the part that matters. This is the part every pilot and every engineer should carry with them. In the spring of 1953, a comet came apart in a storm shortly after taking off from Calcutta. They chalked it up to weather. Terrible, but airplanes and thunderstorms have never been friends. Then in January of 1954, a comet named Yoke Peter took off from Rome, climbing out over the blue Mediterranean near the island of Elba. Clear day, no storm, nothing wrong, and at altitude, with no warning at all, she simply broke apart in the sky and fell into the sea. Everyone aboard was lost. BOAC grounded the whole fleet. Engineers went over everything they could think of. They made dozens of modifications, chasing every theory they had. Fire, engine trouble, sabotage. They found nothing conclusive. And under enormous pressure, with no smoking gun, they put the comet back in the air. 2 weeks later, a second one, out of Rome again, climbing over Naples, same clear conditions, same sudden total structural failure, gone into the sea. Now the fleet was grounded for good, and Britain launched one of the most important accident investigations in the history of flight. They pulled what they could of Yoke Peter up off the bottom of the Mediterranean, piece by piece, in one of the first great deep-water wreckage recoveries ever attempted. And they did something nobody had really done before. They decided to test the airplane to destruction. They took a whole Comet fuselage and they built a giant water tank around it. Water, because if you test with air pressure and the thing lets go, you get an explosion that destroys the evidence. Water just floods out. So they filled the cabin, pressurized it, then relieved the pressure over and over, pumping that fuselage up and letting it back down, simulating flight after flight after flight, cramming years of service into weeks of testing. And after the equivalent of thousands of flights, the fuselage failed, it cracked open. And here, ladies and gentlemen, is the lesson. Here's what those men in that water tank discovered. The crack started at the corner of a window, metal fatigue. Now every one of us who's flown a while knows the word, but back then it was barely understood in airframes. When you pressurize a cabin, the whole fuselage swells up a little, like a balloon. Climb, and it swells, descend, and it shrinks. Every single flight, and metal, when you flex it back and forth enough times, gets tired. It develops tiny cracks. And those cracks want to start wherever the stress piles up. Where does stress pile up? At a sharp corner. At the corner of a square window. Remember those beautiful picture windows? Turned out the stress concentrated at those square corners like water pooling at the low point of a ramp. Little cracks began there, invisible, growing a hair with every pressurization cycle. Until one day, at altitude, with the cabin pumped up tight, a crack reached its limit, and the whole pressurized fuselage unzipped in an instant. That's what killed Yoke Peter, and the one over Naples after her. It wasn't a storm, it wasn't sabotage, it was a sharp corner and the honest, brutal arithmetic of metal fatigue that no one had fully reckoned with. And I want you to sit with how much we owe to that discovery. Because the Comet's people and the British investigators, they did the hard, humble thing. They admitted they'd found the edge of what humanity understood about building airplanes, and they published it. All of it. That's why, when you look out the window of any airliner flying today, that window is a rounded oval. Every single one. No sharp corners. Those gentle, rounded corners on the window next to your seat are a direct physical monument to the men and women lost on the Comet. Boeing learned it. Douglas learned it. Everybody learned it, and they learned it for free because Britain paid the tuition and handed the world the textbook. The way we inspect for fatigue cracks, the way we think about pressurization cycles instead of just flight hours, the whole idea that a structure has a fatigue life, that you track the cycles, that you go looking for cracks before they find you, so much of that discipline traces straight back to a water tank in England in 1954. Now the story doesn't quite end in tragedy, and I don't want to leave you there. De Havilland went back to the drawing board. They redesigned her, thicker skin, rounded windows, all the hard lessons baked in. She came back as the Comet 4, a fine, safe airplane. And in 1958, a Comet 4 flew the first transatlantic jet passenger service west across the ocean, London to New York. But by then, the Americans had caught up and blown past. The Boeing 707 and the Douglas DC-8 were coming, bigger, longer-legged, and built on everything the Comet had bled to teach. Britain had lit the torch. America carried it the rest of the way. And there's one more chapter that would tickle any pilot. That clean, capable Comet airframe got turned into a maritime patrol airplane called the Nimrod, and she soldiered on for the Royal Air Force, hunting submarines and standing watch all the way into the 21st century. That basic design, first flown on the grass at Hatfield on this very day in 1949, was still flying in military service more than 50 years later. Think about that. So the next time you settle into your seat on an airliner and you slide that little shade up and you look out at a wing sitting on top of the weather in that smooth, quiet, high-altitude air we all take for granted now, I want you to notice the shape of the window. Look at the rounded corners. That's the Comet. That's John Cunningham lifting off into the English evening. That's the future arriving before we fully understood it. And the honest, painful, priceless work of figuring out why she broke. Every smooth ride you've ever had up high is standing on the shoulders of that airplane and the people who flew her. My thanks this morning to the De Havilland Aircraft Museum in England, whose keepers guard this story, and to the published findings of the British Comet Inquiry, which taught our whole trade how metal really breaks. If you want more of these, you know where to find us, over at radiohanger.com. That's the airplane that gave us the sky above the weather and paid dearly to do it. Reason enough to tip your hat on a July morning. This is Taildragger. Keep the shiny side up, and I'll see you back here in the hangar.